forthwith. All right, the Lord be with you. Let us pray. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, who has committed to thy holy church the care and nurture of thy people, enlighten with thy wisdom those who teach and those who learn, that rejoicing in the knowledge of thy truth, they may worship thee and serve thee from generation to generation, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Okay, we're still on authorship. For some reason, I thought we were going to rip through this all in one day, and it turned out to be several days of authorship. So we went through the Old Testament, especially the first five books. We've been through the Pauline epistles. These are where the real fights have gone down about authorship. And we're finally here at the Gospels. There are other directions that we can go in our discussion of authorship and higher criticism. Some points of the prophetic books are lightning rods as well, especially the book of Isaiah. And maybe we'll get to Isaiah if there's enough interest in Isaiah. But for now, we're going to do the Gospels, because there ought to be some interest in the Gospels. We'll start with the tradition, which is a very important place to start when you're considering the authorship of the Gospels, because actually the authorship of the whole Bible. Because any question of this started about 100 years ago or 150 years ago. What has the church believed for century after century after century after century? This is a picture of St. Augustine. Until 150 years ago, Matthew was thought to be the first gospel written. Matthew is numero uno. Irenaeus, 2nd century. Origen, 3rd century. Eusebius, I think 4th century. He's the great historian of the early church. Our three early witnesses. St. Augustine was the first to espouse an actual ordered theory to how the Gospels came about. And interestingly, it is almost exactly the opposite of modern scholars. So modern scholars take what the church has always believed and say, let's turn this all upside down. That's how you get published, by the way, as I understand. Here is the Augustinian hypothesis, a quote from his work, The Harmony of the Gospels. St. Augustine says, "Now those four evangelists whose names have gained the most remarkable circulation over the whole world, and whose number has been fixed as four, are believed to have written," notice he's not making this up, he's writing here in the 5th century, and for centuries it's already been believed, they were written in the following order: first Matthew, then Mark, thirdly Luke, and lastly John. It's not exactly the opposite, but for the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those are called the synoptics, the order has been reversed in modern scholarship, just about. This certainly is not to be taken as if each individual writer chose to write in ignorance of what his predecessor had done. So even in the early centuries, there was no idea that each of these gospel writers just descended from the ivory tower with a new idea, and it just happened to be the same as the other fellow. There's no need to really go crazy on that. There's no reason to believe that Matthew, Mark, and Luke would not be aware of each other, that Mark would not be aware of Matthew, that Luke would not be aware of Matthew or Mark. And so here is the Augustinian hypothesis on how the Synoptic Gospels came to be. Matthew is written first, and Mark is written second. St. Augustine, and this is really important to catch, I think, St. Augustine refers to Mark as the abbreviator of Matthew. It's a pretty simple explanation. He just abbreviates Matthew. This is taken, we'll get to it in a second, this is taken to be an impossibility in the later academic circles. The impossibility of somebody abbreviating someone else. And if you can think of a reason why it's impossible, I'd love to hear it. Why can't it be true that Mark was a popular writer? He skips right to the action, doesn't give a long genealogy or nativity story. If you compare Mark and Matthew, I don't know if you've ever read a Reader's Digest version of something. You know what came first? The original, and then the Reader's Digest, right? The Reader's Digest doesn't come first, and then the longer version. So the idea of many of the early church fathers was that Mark was an abbreviator of Matthew. and that he was a popular writer. He knew that some people that were reading this gospel, just as many people today, when they open the first chapter and they say, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so, I mean, before you're at the second or third chapter of Matthew, you're just saying, oh, brother, am I really going to read this whole thing? I give up. So Matthew says, how about we skip right to the punch, and then we make this gospel filled with miracles and let's make it shorter. How about 10 chapters shorter than Matthew? What's wrong with that? Anybody? No. Good. In the modern scheme, though, Mark is thought to be not popular, but primitive. In other words, does that sound familiar? Primitive. So the idea of a primitive writer, you can guess how things evolved. I'm not really, in fact, knocking the biological explanation of things through Darwin. I'm just saying that the idea that Darwin brought into the middle of the 19th century did not stay with the Origin of Species. It populated everything, all kinds of philosophy and history, sociology, everything it populated. It was just like fire in a grass pile or something. So yes, Darwin again. The evolutionary presupposition of biblical criticism. I don't think Darwin would have ever thought that this would be applied to biblical criticism, but it was. So the assumption is that an earlier text, and you can guess, just like a single cell amoeba or something like that, an earlier text will be shorter, will be simpler, and more problematic. That's a little wrench there at the end. But of course, something that's going to evolve into something greater is going to be shorter in the initial, like a single-celled amoeba turns into a fish with legs, turns into a person one day. I'm not really talking about biology. I'm just saying that idea populates to this. The earlier text will be simpler in terms of theology. It won't have as developed a theology. And it will be more problematic. In other words, I'm not talking about biology, but you know, if an animal develops with three legs, eventually the four-legged animal will survive the fittest, right? So the longer-legged animal will survive the other. So in other words, you would look for a more problematic reading in an earlier text. That's if you come to biblical criticism with sort of a Darwinian mindset. And this is how it gets a little weird. Higher criticism, gospel rule. I'm just sort of making a play on words with gospel there. Lectio difficilior potior is the name in Latin of the rule that becomes sort of at the base of textual criticism and biblical criticism. The more difficult reading is the more probable reading. Get it? Where manuscripts differ on a word, the more unusual word is likely the original. You have to get this in your head, okay? So I come to a text that, I think my next little thing will help. The worse a manuscript is, the more we revere it, sort of. What does that presuppose? Do you get it? When we come to two texts, and one of them is written well, and the other one sounds similar, but it's written poorly, the poor one is the original, because it must have been evolved. It must have evolved into the better one, right? So the whole idea of shorter, poorer, more difficult readings being the original ones is an idea that's behind all of this. So you have to sort of get that in your head. It fits with sort of an evolutionary mindset of the scriptures. It presupposes, though, number one, it would be obvious to you if you took those as your presuppositions, that Mark is the shortest of the Gospels and simpler by some accounts. So it's thought by most also to be the more difficult of the synoptic gospels because the Greek is not as smooth and there are repetitions. So, is it hard to imagine young Mark making sentences no work good? If young Mark makes sentences no work good, maybe he's just not as accomplished a writer as Matthew. That could be. But you can see where this is going. Mark becomes, regardless of the entire historical tradition of the church, including those that write within a century, within decades of the actual writing of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all of that is ignored because now we have a superior way of evaluating ancient texts. The short ones, the difficult ones, those are the originals. And we reverse the whole scheme based on that mindset. I don't think it's all that hard to imagine, though, young Mark making sentences no work good. Young Mark, first of all, is young Mark. Second of all, he's trying to write in a popular way. I don't think it's so strange to find such a scenario. But the main point for I guess you could say traditionalists as ourselves is the idea that the entire history and belief of the church for 19 centuries is disregarded, junk, the dust heap of history. That doesn't appeal to me so much. When we keep going with this, the whole idea about the authorship of the Gospels, you can see a couple of other things start to emerge. Here's another assumption of biblical critics. The earliest Christians did not believe in the deity of Christ. The deity of Christ was an evolution, right? It evolved into that idea. So it's going to get a little weirder here. A very complicated scheme is developed to support this now sacred theory, okay? First, we choose Mark as the original gospel writer. And you could see that would be kind of important to build this theory on because Mark was not an eyewitness, right? Matthew and Luke were eyewitnesses, but Mark wasn't. So in the reversal of things, turning things upside down and putting Mark first, and Matthew and Luke, the actual eyewitnesses, dependent upon Mark, you start to suggest that it wasn't Matthew and it wasn't Luke that wrote Matthew and Luke either. So the first gospel is not an eyewitness. Second, later Christians used Mark and a much more original, faithful source to produce Matthew and Luke. These are the assumptions that start to be developed in the sort of popular scholarly mindset. If you can say that the earliest Christians did not believe in the deity of Christ and that the idea of the deity of Christ was an evolution, you've even got to sort of tackle Mark a little bit. And even though he's your earliest, you're going to punch him in the gut once. And then Matthew and Luke you can take care of later. John, that's the least of our worries. And so, set afire by the flames of hell, I'm just kidding, we invent a document that we call Q, which is just awesome. You'll see how weird this gets in just a moment. Q, short for the German, I would say Quell or Kel, meaning source. Q is a hypothetical document containing the sayings of Jesus without any claim of divinity, death, or resurrection. Okay? We have a theory. The theory is that the original Christians didn't believe in the deity of Christ. We've reversed Matthew for Mark. We've put Luke way out over here. But where did this idea of the divinity of Christ come from? Must have been later. Therefore, what is earlier is just a collection of what we believe Jesus to be, a teacher, a really nice guy that everyone just appreciated and just had such neat things that he said. Where is the collection of the neat things that Jesus said? It must have been in some document that we haven't found yet, from which all the other Gospels drew and created their own Gospels, adding in a theology of the divinity of Christ. In order for all these theories to work, you have to invent something for which there is no evidence other than mental evidence. There is no scrap or text or papyrus from the sands of ancient Egypt that has been produced that has anything to do with Q. But it is in the mind, that's for sure. It does not exist. But nevertheless, a whole mythology of the people of Q. See how weird this gets? How far you have to go? The people of Q was imagined to make higher critical theorists, and this is sort of a critique of the critics, higher critical theorists see and find themselves in the first century. Okay? The people of Q. First of all, you don't even have a Q. There is no Q. Now you have an anthropology of Q people. Okay? Gets pretty weird. And you've heard, and this is why we sort of are very leery, and I try to tell you to be leery about the Gospel of Thomas. Whenever the Gospel of Thomas, whenever they uncover a new text and write an article about it in which magazine? Time Magazine, Gospel of Thomas, National Geographic, Gospel of Thomas, the Ossuary of Jesus, and all these things start popping up. The Gospel of Thomas was a 2nd to 4th century document that every church father who ever referred to it was condemned as a Gnostic heretic, okay? Gnosticism, the idea that God could not have come down and dwelt among us. The Word could not have become flesh and dwelt among us, okay? This, the earliest Gospel of Thomas, when it was written, was late 2nd century to 4th century, somewhere in there where Gnosticism kicks up in the church as an official heresy. But on the hopes that Q exists, the Gospel of Thomas is run to very often, because the Gospel of Thomas is a collection of the really nice things that Jesus said with no reference to his divinity, which is just what a Gnostic would say, and it's just what a scholar would long to hear, and just what they would hope to find in the document of Q, which doesn't exist. But if we're going to invent some people, let's have some critique of the critics. George Tyrrell was the first. Albert Schweitzer was the next to say something like this. Schweitzer is more often quoted as have saying this. The Christ that they see, looking back through 19 centuries of Catholic darkness in their mind, is only the reflection of a liberal Protestant face seen at the bottom of a deep well. In other words, we're looking back through 19 centuries of what they would consider Catholic darkness. And what is the reflection that they see? Themselves. That's who Jesus is. Albert Schweitzer is part of a movement called the Quest for the Historical Jesus. And the quest for the historical Jesus almost always produces a Jesus that looks just like the author. A scientist writes something that would fall into the category of the quest for the historical Jesus and finds Jesus to be much like a scientist. A social worker creates a history of the historical Jesus and produces a Jesus that looks just like a social worker. We look back down to find Jesus, and what we find is our own reflection. Here's an example of how to find yourself. This is a quote from Burton Mack, who is a Q scholar. Now, if I could think of something to waste your life on, I think it would be studying a document that does not exist, that you have no evidence for other than the idea of it. So he's a Q scholar. The remarkable thing about the people of Q, oh boy, is that they were not Christians, as yourself. They did not think of Jesus as a Messiah of the Christ, as yourself. They did not take his teachings as an indictment of Judaism. They did not regard his death as divine, tragic, or saving event, as you don't. And they did not imagine that he had been raised from the dead to rule over a transformed world, as you don't. Instead, they thought of him as a teacher whose teaching made it possible to live with verve in troubled times, as you do. Thus, they did not gather to worship in his name, as you don't, honor him as God, as you don't, or cultivate his memory through hymns, prayers, and rituals, as you don't. They did not form a cult of the Christ such as the one that emerged among the Christian communities familiar to readers of the letters of Paul. The people of Q were Jesus people, not Christians. Okay, so what has Mr. Mack found as he casts his vision back through 19 centuries of Catholic darkness? He sees himself. And even better than the community from which the Gospel of Mark or Matthew or Luke was produced is the Q document, and even the people of Q. Those are his people. These are my people, Q. I don't know if you've ever driven down the street and seen the first church of Q. It doesn't exist, right? Because you don't have to go to church if you believe in Q. You don't have to do anything. You can go bowling. And the bowling alleys, I don't know if they're open this morning, but maybe that's where the Q people hang out. You can do whatever you want. Anyway, that's Q. Q was postulated in the mid-1800s. Anything else happened in the mid-1800s? A lot of things happened. It was used to explain common material in the Synoptic Gospels. So when you find that Matthew, Mark, and Luke have common material, aha, that's the Q material, okay? And to support the idea that claims of Christ's divinity and atoning sacrifice were later additions to the Christian faith. All this becomes very difficult to defend when you realize that Paul's epistles were written before the Gospels were written. In many cases, and so when Paul's writing about the divinity of Christ and the Gospels are written afterwards, that makes a little bit of a mental pretzel. The 2nd to 4th century Gospel of Thomas is what scholars hope a 1st century, and what they really need it to be, is between 35 and 65 AD. That's what we really need a Q document to be. If they could just find one, a scrap, then this whole thing might hold some water. And once you have a Q, you soon have to believe in an M and an L and other hypothetical sources. And it reminds us of JEDP. You remember the map? You not only have JEDP, but you have J, you have D, D1 and D2. You have E, and then you have an R, a redactor. And before long, you have a whole map of sources that you need. By the way, all this together is called source criticism, if you've ever heard of that before. We're searching for sources. And what I'm obviously purporting is that the sources are not just random sources uncovered in the sands. There's a motivation and a set of presuppositions behind this whole philosophy that you find so popularly in the world today. So, once you have a Q, you're going to need an M and an L, and you're going to need some others. So, here is the new gospel source theory. You remember St. Augustine's, Augustinian hypothesis, that Matthew wrote first, Mark abbreviated, and Luke wrote later. Here we have Mark writing first, Matthew and Luke writing second, but they have to get material that does not come from Mark, has to come from Q. So you've got another document here. Q has got to supply information to Matthew and Luke. Notice information of eyewitnesses is not considered at all. Just because you were there and heard Jesus say it, we don't go there. But what about the material that appears in Matthew that doesn't appear in Luke, that doesn't come from Mark? Well, it couldn't have been Matthew. We all know that. So it has to be a hypothetical Matthew document or an M document. Luke, same problem. We're sure that it wasn't Luke that wrote it. So if it didn't come from Mark and it didn't come from Q and it didn't come from M and it had to come from L, you don't have a Q. You don't have an M. You don't have an L. Where do these come from? These are all part of a hypothesis that preserves a presupposition that we're trying to go with. John, of course, now needs to be John taking from Mark, but also from three separate sources, because it surely couldn't have been John. I think it's much more simple to go this way. St. Augustine, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, okay? Matthew is an eyewitness. Mark and Luke were hearing from the eyewitness and were along with St. Paul on his journeys. What is missing from the Augustinian hypothesis? Complication. What is missing from this hypothesis? Obfuscation. What is missing is imagination. It actually takes much less imagination to just believe what the church has always said about the Gospels. Much less imagination, much less hypothetical documents, much less stressing and straining. You remember when we first started this course, we pointed out the presuppositions of higher criticism, and one is that God does not intervene in this world. How do you start by examining the New Testament when your presupposition is God doesn't intervene in this world? The incarnation of Christ, I'm sorry, is an intervention in this world. You have to start by disbelieving almost everything that's said in the New Testament. And from there, you develop things like an imaginary Q, an imaginary people of Q, an M, an L, all different kinds of sources, and nothing short of what I think is a devious intent of the early church to obscure and to lie to people about the truth. Of course, taking into account the fact that all of these early apostles and evangelists practically were martyred for their faith. I don't know if you've ever been martyred for something you didn't believe in, but that doesn't happen very often. They ask you to recant and you say no, even though knowing yourself it's not true. Would you be crucified upside down for something you knew was false? I think you'd probably cave at the last minute if you ask me. But if you knew that it was true, and you believed that it was true, that makes a little bit more sense. We're going to wrap up with what C.S. Lewis says here. And I think this is a great article he wrote about higher criticism itself. Writing not as a higher critic himself, but as a man of letters. That we know now, because of our great learning, much better than the ancient witnesses concerning authorship. Now this surely ought to give us pause. And even before he explains it, you should say, hold on a second. We know better now because of our great learning. The reconstruction of the history of a text, when the text is ancient, sounds very convincing. But one is, after all, sailing by dead reckoning. The results cannot be checked by fact. And if you read this whole article, you'll see that he's examining these ancient documents and these claims that are made, but he points out the fact that he was good friends with J.R. Tolkien. And J.R. Tolkien wrote something about which all the critics knew where this came from. The ring, right? The ring must have symbolized the nuclear bomb. And they had it, you know, lock, stock, barrel, and bayonet. The ring of the Lord of the Rings is the nuclear bomb, and that's what Tolkien was writing about. Now, he's a friend of J.R.R. Tolkien and knows that it's not correct. They're trying to recreate something from within their own generation, their own people. People are still alive that you could go and ask and disprove, and they got it wrong. Now we're going to use our great intellect and go back 19 centuries where everybody's dead and nobody has a chance to defend themselves. And boy, do we have a theory. The superiority and judgment and diligence which you are going to attribute to the biblical critics will have to be almost superhuman if it is to offset the fact that they are everywhere faced with customs, language, race characteristics, class characteristics, a religious background, habits of composition, and basic assumptions which no scholarship will ever enable any man alive to know as surely and intimately and instinctively as the reviewer can know even my writings. He's speaking of his own. And for the very same reason, remember, the biblical critics, whatever reconstructions they devise, can never be crudely proven wrong. You can't prove the Q guy wrong, which is why he could still publish the Q document. You can't prove him wrong. The only thing you can do, which is what I think the church's position is much better, is to trust generation upon generation upon generation of the church fathers who actually were very close to this in the earlier back you go. And this is a little jibe, but he says, St. Mark is dead, okay? You can't go check with St. Mark to see if your theory of how St. Mark was written is dead. He probably shouldn't say this, but when they meet St. Peter, they'll have more pressing matters to discuss. That's a little too much. I shouldn't have put that in there. But I didn't say it. C.S. Lewis said it. So that's basically the idea is that...
British humor,
yes. It's a little morose, I must say. But it is true. What he gets at is that there's something darker going on here than just scholarship. We began with the presupposition that God does not exist and he's not interested in us, even if he did exist, and he doesn't intervene in this world, and a long chain of cause and effect is the only thing that is really going on here, and you are just a bag of bones and water and blood, and there's no real purpose behind anything, and there's no real meaning, and there's no salvation, and there's no spiritual life, and all of this is junk, and we're just historians going back to uncover from the dust of history this old Bible and prayer book. That's the presupposition, and that is wicked. And he says it doesn't hold water, but there's no way you're going to argue with St. Mark. He's dead. So you can say whatever you want, and if they publish you, you're in. But we got some questions left for us to explain, to be honest. And this is the end of today, but we'll get into this next week. Questions like, how do you explain similarities in text between Gospels? How do you explain differences in accounts of Jesus' sayings, if copyists didn't add or subtract from Jesus' words? How do you explain discrepancies if all the accounts are true? This passage says that Jesus healed one person. This passage says that he healed two. This passage says that he went from here to the temple. This passage is about the same thing, says he went from here to Galilee. How do we handle these kind of things? And how can we be happy with an incomplete historical account? If you want to talk about a historical account, you find that Mark starts, you know, two decades or more after Jesus' nativity. What kind of a historical account of a person's life starts that late? How are we going to be happy as 21st century scientifically minded folks? How are you going to be happy with an incomplete historical account? Those are some of the questions we'll tackle next week. And probably some other stuff too. The end. Any questions about the Gospels, authorship? Where a lot of commentaries, when you open, they'll say, of course, this passage comes from Q, and you know, we're not really sure, you know, what the mindset was behind the redactor who put all this stuff together. All that kind of stuff you have to sift through, unfortunately. But any questions about all that stuff? No, I've talked you into neutral. Very good. And then we're going to clear out. Thank you very much.
Okay,